Thanks, Chairman Will, members of the committee. My name is Chris Rose. I'm the Executive Director of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. I'm going to give a brief overview and then present Bert Hunter, who's the Chief Investment Officer of the Connecticut Green Bank, who's been kind enough to come to Alaska for the second time this year to talk about what is happening in Connecticut and bringing private investment to clean energy. As you know, REAP is a coalition of 80 organizations around the state focused on promoting clean energy, energy efficiency, and renewable energy. Since 2008, we've been supporting a number of programs that have been really successful here. For instance, the HFC program that many people have taken advantage of to weatherize their homes, either through weatherization or rebate. More than 40,000 homes have been weatherized through that program. The average savings was 30%. That's mostly on the thermal side. HFC estimates that those 40,000 homes are collectively saving the equivalent of 25 million gallons of heating oil every year. So even at $2 a gallon, that's $50 million of savings that's staying in our economy every year just through that program. The Renewable Energy Fund was another program that was passed back in 2008. The legislature appropriated $259 million for projects. That leveraged another $200 million in federal and private money to build projects. The 60 projects that have been completed through that program, AEA estimates, are saving 30 million gallons of diesel every year. So again, at $2 a gallon, which is probably low for many bush communities, $60 million a year savings. I guess the point is that these projects have been successful in keeping dollars in our economy, but now the grant money is gone because of our state budget situation, and we want to keep the momentum. We want to keep these kinds of projects going, particularly on the energy efficiency side, and the projects that we know, for instance, through the Renewable Energy Fund that have already been vetted, those projects don't have any grant money to keep going. But how can we leverage private money to come in and do this? $5 billion a year is what we estimate that Alaskans are paying every year on energy. So collectively, when we talk about transportation, heating, and electricity, we're spending $5 billion a year right now. That's the status quo. And if you look at the fact that we're saving 30% on energy in residences, and we know we can do that in commercial buildings, and we know we can have more efficient electricity, a 20% savings of that $5 billion is keeping $1 billion in our economy. And to do that, we would have to invest, and we would create a ton of jobs, and we create a situation where we keep $1 billion in our economy every year while we create those jobs. But there has to be some catalyst to do that. And our eye was really caught by looking around and saying, hey, we're at a crossroads here in Alaska. How are we going to keep financing these projects at the Connecticut Green Bank? It's the first green bank in the United States. It was established just a few years ago in 2011, and it's had tremendous success so far in only the 5 or 6 years that it's been around. So we're really lucky to have Bert Hunter come up in January. At that time, he presented to investors, gave a public presentation, met with the Commissioner of Transportation and others. Tomorrow we'll be meeting with the Mayor of Anchorage and hopefully some Assembly members, having lunch with a bunch of bankers in Anchorage and a bunch of HFC personnel. We are meeting with Commissioner Laddick later today, met with Commissioner Hoffbeck last night. We're really just trying to socialize this idea of what has happened in Connecticut, and so people can get some kind of a concept of what might be possible here. The emphasis that I know Bert will give is we're not competing with the private sector. A green bank really is allowing the private sector easier access into these markets. And so with that, I'd like to introduce Bert Hunter, who's the Chief Investment Officer and Vice President of the Connecticut Green Bank.
Great. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate that introduction. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for inviting me here today and for the members of the committee. Representative Westlake, good to see you again. It's deja vu all over again, as some famous person once said. So some of my comments will be repetitive, but thank you for coming for the second half of the doubleheader.
Mr. Hunter, just for the record, can you put your name and affiliation?
Yes, sir. My name is Bert Hunter. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of the Connecticut Green Bank.
Thank you.
So before giving my presentation on green banks and about the Connecticut Green Bank, I thought it'd be helpful to offer some background to the committee on what we've done in Connecticut and how that came about. So as Chris mentioned, we were formed back in 2011 by our Governor Dan Malloy and the Connecticut Legislature. The legislation was passed nearly unanimously by both sides, both parts of the legislature. Senate unanimously, the House 165 out of 170 votes, something close to that. But it was popular on both sides of the aisle because the energy policy that was introduced that brought us into being spoke to reducing the energy burden on businesses and residents as well as benefits to our economy and the environment. We too had a clean energy fund. You had a renewable energy fund. Ours was established in about 1999, so it operated throughout the 2000s. But it was really just an incentive organization, so it handed out rebates, sometimes financing 100% of the project, more often just about half of the project. So really $1 for $1. And in that span of time, it did $350 million worth of projects. What the Green Bank has done in half the time, being established in 2011, in half the time we've done over $1 billion worth, so more than three times the amount of investment in less than half the time. And that is because the focus of a Green Bank is to attract more private investment for clean energy deployment. And as Chris mentioned, we do that by partnering with financial institutions, not pushing capital out of the market, which many government programs often do. They make loans that the private sector can do. We do the financing that actually encourages more private investment into the market. And we do it for clean energy, and in Connecticut, when we say clean energy, we mean a whole range of activities from energy efficiency to solar, PV, oil-to-gas conversions, which is very important for us, renewable thermal, electric vehicle charging networks and such, wind, small hydro, fuel cells. We have a fuel cell two fuel cell manufacturers in our state, so that's all very important to us. So we do this by using public dollars to attract local banks, credit unions, national lenders, global financial institutions in order to provide businesses, consumers, and even municipalities and schools with access to affordable capital to solve their clean energy needs. I was mentioning to Chris when we were having dinner last night that 5 years ago we were established, we had to go knocking on the doors of all these banks and try to get the attention of them. Well, 5 years later and after $1 billion worth of business, they're knocking on our doors seeing how they can partner with us so they can get a part of the business activity that we're generating. Our Green Bank has a number of programs and financial products that are helping Connecticut citizens achieve their own energy conservation and energy choice goals while helping Connecticut meet its ambitious environmental goals. Such improvements help our industrial manufacturers become more competitive by lowering their energy costs, and we provide incentives and financing for homeowners that want to install solar PV or upgrade to cleaner and more efficient boilers for space heating. We also help businesses and communities invest in microgrids, which is a very important activity understanding here in Alaska. We have a devotion also to our most economically challenged communities, where energy costs for these residents consume 15, 20, or 25% or more of their income, which is many multiples higher than consumers who or families that have income of moderate and upper amounts of income. So we have many residents that are aging in place, a high proportion of fixed incomes. So we work with our social service agencies, departments of housing, community development, financial institutions to reach these families and help them lower the energy burden that they bear. And all of this not only has benefits for businesses and families, but it also has an enormous impact on economic development for the state. As I said, we've driven over $1 billion in the first 5 years. That represents $12,500 direct and indirect job years, and that's in a state which in the same period of time generated 60,000 net new jobs. So remember, when we reduce the amount of income that's being used for energy costs, which for the most part in Connecticut is actually leaving the state, or actually even leaving the country, going elsewhere, it can be spent or invested locally in more goods and services and capital equipment to grow our local economy. So the business of clean energy investment is a real economic shot in the arm for us, our state's economy. It just makes good sense to do it. I really applaud you for exploring green banks and what they might be able to do for Alaska. And with that, I'm happy to take any initial questions on green banks, and then I'll go on with my presentation.
I have a question, if no one from the committee does, but Representative Johnson.
And I'm kind of a little fearful of asking a question because you might be addressing this in your presentation.
Sure.
But how do you incorporate federal tax credits and federal programs in your...
We do that in a couple of ways. With federal tax credits for solar, we actually established a solar fund with U.S. Bank. And KeyBank also provided some financing into that fund, and we provided some co-investment in that fund. So in that particular structure, U.S. Bank was able to utilize the tax credits, and they then offered a benefit to the fund in exchange for being able to use those tax credits. And that enabled us to provide power purchase agreements and solar leases to homeowners and small businesses for solar.
And do you know a percentage of your billion-dollar investment is dependent? How much of that is dependent on the federal programs?
Probably about half right now, but it's decreasing over time. So in other words, the other half would be pure energy efficiency. We also have an incentive program that we manage that actually provides homeowners and third-party owners of the equipment, like our solar fund that I just described. But we provide that incentive on a declining basis. So right now, it's a very small proportion of the amount of funding that actually goes towards those projects. The federal tax credit is still 30%, but that's going to be declining as we get toward 2022.
Thank you.
I have a question. In Connecticut, when these investments are coming in for certain energy projects, and you mentioned fuel cells, for example, and Alaska might be different in that some of these projects are factories or companies that are making stuff for export, I'm imagining. It's not just in-state consumption. And what proportion are to guesstimate? How much of these investments are for sort of export or just general business, and how much is for in-state energy consumption?
That's a good question in terms of if we break it down that way. I would say that roughly about 30% is for commercial and industrial. Mm-hmm. And I'd say 70% is for residential, including multifamily.
Okay.
In terms of proportion.
Thank you.
That's an estimate, so I can get you better figures later.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. My question kind of goes along with Representative Johnston's question on the feds and how much they, you know, really contribute to the different types of programs and tax credits. And I've been kind of following who's going to be appointed for the Energy Secretary. The Department of Energy, is that mostly nuclear? I mean, do they stay? How much of the Department of Energy in the national level are they doing contributing towards green programs, or is that done through a whole different department?
They do a lot. The Department of Energy does a lot in terms of energy innovation. So they try to incentivize through co-investment to have innovation in energy efficiency. So if there's a new methodology, it's like a fuel cell. If there's a high efficiency fuel cell that comes along, but it's at the pilot phase. It's not at the commercialization phase yet. So they would entertain a proposal to lend the developer funds to actually make that a commercialized process or investment. But they do that. They've had a number of investment programs on the energy side, not nuclear side, but that was related to the 2000. 2009 stimulus bill. Those programs have pretty much run their course, so I think that they're being wound up right now. Okay.
Okay. Well, once you hear your presentation.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. And you can ask questions as we go along. This is a general agenda for the day. We'll talk about the Green Bank, some Green Bank basics, some of our benefits and impacts, some of our projects and program examples, how we work with foundations and green bonds, and then the Green Bank movement more nationally and internationally. So just to give some definition to how the scale of our Green Bank, we, as I mentioned, we were formed out of the Clean Energy Fund. We had a $60 million capital base to work with. We focus on clean energy, as I described, including energy efficiency, importantly. And we've grown our balance sheet from that $60 million in 5 years to $175 million in assets. That represents a lot of investments that we've put on our books, but lending with the private sector. We're supported by a slight surcharge on everybody's electric bill, 1/10 of a cent per kilowatt hour. And that translates in our state to $27 million or so per year, which is pretty stable because the consumption of electricity is pretty level in our state. And we also participate in a regional greenhouse gas initiative, which is a kind of a carbon cap and trade program by northeastern states and a couple of mid-Atlantic states. That generates for us about $5 million a year in income. We also, because we're generating all those assets, the $175 million in assets, we also have portfolio income, roughly $2 to $3 million a year right now, but that's growing as that portfolio is now spinning off income. And we also get, to the point about tax credits and government programs, we also apply to the U.S. government for various initiatives. We have had about $8 million worth of ERA funds, American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds, which we've put to use in some of our programs that we'll talk about today. Obviously, going forward with the government, you know, changing direction at the top in terms of clean energy initiatives, that's going to be less of an impact for us, but we're still getting money from private foundations. Connecticut is 3.6 million people, $225 billion in terms of gross state product, and that ranks number 3 per capita. We'll get into some of the other issues in terms of kind of relating it to Alaska. You know, both of us have very high cost electricity in our state. In fact, in the areas that benefit from the PCE here in Alaska, the cost for electricity is far above that, and I'm sure is tops in the nation. So that's certainly a concern and something that we both have to deal with. These are the challenges that really drove the formation of our Green Bank. Those high energy costs. We have a very old building stock, whether you're talking about single family homes or you're talking about multifamily or commercial real estate, it's just old. It was built in large measure prior to 1980. I think in Alaska, I think your benchmark is probably pre-1990. But if you look at that, that means that most of your building stock is more than a quarter century old and is probably suffering from energy efficiency issues. We want to diversify our energy mix into cleaner resources. We are heavily dependent on natural gas and the New England ISO, the independent system operator, that area of the grid. Green reliability, whenever we have a storm, major parts of our state lose power. It's some parts for a few hours, many parts for days. And so that's been a focus to try to improve resiliency throughout our grid.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Did you say you're highly dependent on natural gas? I thought Connecticut was more oil.
No.
Natural gas now, so down the pipeline from Central Canadian.
Our gas comes basically from across the Hudson River. All the way from the southeast, all the way up. In fact, that causes the fact that we get our gas supply substantially from across the Hudson River. You know, those pipelines are established, they're fixed. there's no new capacity on there. So in the wintertime, quite often there's constraint, and that causes the price for natural gas to spike, and that ripples through into the electricity price. So so we face those issues as well. In terms of our government spending, this might resonate here. We have some deficits that we're dealing with, so we're not looking to our government to take more resources, but we're really looking to the resources that we have. Fortunately, they're devoted through our system benefit charge, as well as redirecting any existing resources that are not being used. So sometimes we will make a plea to our government the same. Yeah, if a certain part of government is not using their resources, maybe devote them to us, because we're stimulating economic development and reducing energy costs. So, and that's been received that rather well. Here's the basics of the Green Bank model. Literally a government, state government, or in some cases in Montgomery County in Maryland, they've established a Green Bank themselves. I actually sit on the board. I'm the chairman of that board. For that local Green Bank, but it's sponsored by government, and it establishes a bit of capital to capitalize the Green Bank, and the purpose of the Green Bank is to mitigate the risk for private investors to a certain extent. So it's not to take away all risk, but it's to moderate the risk of projects. So we'll show you how we do that at the Green Bank, and that's so these low-carbon projects can be developed and substantially energy efficiency and renewables. And this is how we operate. We operate on basically three ways. Co-investment, where we will join with other private capital banks or other financial institutions to finance a project or a series of projects, and we will either lend on the same level with them, meaning we'll be both be senior in the transaction, so equal access to the collateral and cash flow. Or sometimes what we do to make it easier for the lender to come in is we will agree to be in second place so that the senior lender will be able to come in more comfortably and have better coverage and better access to the collateral, and we'll take the second place behind the senior lender. That's one way of making them more comfortable. Another way is to offer credit support. We offer a limited guarantee in our residential lending program, where we have community banks and credit unions. I'll talk about that. And then in warehousing, we offer a pool of financing available for our commercial PACE program, where we'll actually do the financing. Traditionally, we have done the financing first and pooled the transactions together, and then we got investors to buy those transactions from us. And that's because these investors, they don't want to look at a $200,000 project or a $50,000 project or $1 million project. They say, come to us with $10 million worth of projects. So if you come to us with $10 million worth of projects, we'll look at them, and then we'll buy them from you. And that's exactly what we did.
You mentioned PACE. We just passed a PACE bill in the House. It's awaiting passage in the Senate. But do you see a lot of activity of those kind of loans?
Absolutely. We in Connecticut has the most active commercial PACE program in the nation. We've done over $100 million in transactions in 2 years. So that's and that represents a considerable. The average size is about, in our state, is about $600,000, but the range is quite big. So we've done $50,000 boilers for churches, and we've done $3 million whole building retrofits for commercial office real estate. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a range, but it's very successful.
Thank you.
And this really is really a repeat of what I mentioned before in terms of our clean energy fund, what it did in 11 years, $350 million of activity and 43 megawatts of clean energy deployment. and really lending on the basis of $1 from us, $1 from the private sector, one to one. Now, in just over 5 years, 208 megawatts of clean energy, so more than almost five times the amount of deployment in less than half the time, and three times the amount of capital, $1 billion in that span of time.
What was the Clean Energy Fund? Was that, was it a loan or was it a grant?
Grant.
Okay, so it was basically free money of sorts, and that's what we've sort of had in Alaska and kind of exhausted.
Right.
And
that's right.
So the reason the number for the loans is a lot higher is because it doesn't rely on grant money. One of the reasons.
Well, yes, and also we're actually encouraging private money is sitting on top of us.
Sure.
So that's the multiplier effect that we're getting.
Representative Johnson.
So we have VC up there. Do you do any venture capital, or so it's basically
that was
very traditional?
That was the old model.
So you're basically doing traditional financing.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And these are, I won't go through all of the items in here, but we put together what's called a comprehensive annual financial report, which not only includes, it's available online, we can get you a link, but I warn you, it's about yay thick, and it's chock full of information. If you're having a sleepless night, you might appreciate it. But the part I want to focus on is one table in that that annual report, which is a lifetime CO2 emissions, which is the final column on the right. So well over 2 million tons of CO2 lifetime saved as a result of our activities in the first 5 years. And this is the financial report that I mentioned. It's something that we're quite happy, proud of. It really encapsulates not only our financial performance, but also our programmatic performance. Here is a list of transactions that we've done with private capital. This is representative. This isn't all of the transactions we've done, clearly, but represents about $500 million worth of capital. You'll see many familiar names: KeyBank, U.S. Bank, the Kresge Foundation, which is doing a energy storage project with us. The MacArthur Foundation is working with us on multifamily initiatives. We also are in the process of getting J.P. Morgan Chase to provide a financing facility for our utilities Small Business Energy Advantage program. So a lot of diversity there. And Mr. Chairman, to your point about commercial pace, draw your attention to the lower left item there. Hannon Armstrong has provided a $100 million facility for our program. And so initially when we started, we used our own balance sheet exclusively to fund the transactions. After 3 years, we went to the market for private capital because they were saying, we want to work with you. Somehow, so we had to do an RFP, and they won by saying, we'll provide up to $100 million facility for you, and we'll lend with you so that you don't have to use all the money on your books. So they provide anywhere from 80 to 90% of the transaction capital that's required. So it really limits the amount of funding that we have to do off of our books.
So that ratio is their investment related ratio to your
to ours. Yeah.
So 100%, the next one over, MacArthur Foundation, they put up 100%.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I've really covered this. I'm not going to, in terms of the benefits, in terms of investments and jobs and the energy burden, but it's certainly substantial impact. So let's talk a bit about some of the programs. Let's look at residential homeowners. One of the first programs we developed was our Smart E Loan, and we did that because we wanted to work with local community banks as well as credit unions to provide, these are unsecured loans for homeowners. Why unsecured? Because if we were to do secured loans, banks are already doing that. They always have the option, homeowners, of getting a home equity line of credit. or even refinancing a first mortgage. But what we wanted to do is we wanted to work more with contractors in a smooth and easy process. But typically a smooth and easy process, is, as many people know, contractors traditionally will offer you a 0% teaser rate, and then in 6 months or 12 months that rate will explode to 24%, and the homeowner is really stuck with a massive financing bill. So we said, look, instead of those teaser rates, can't we have a program where the contractor can work with the community bank or the credit union, and together with the customers and the Green Bank, to offer lower rate loans and for a longer term, so that when the customer finishes with the project, they can actually have money in their pocket after the whole transaction is done. So that was the genesis behind the Smart E-Loan. And what we did was we took some of those ERA dollars, let me just finish and I'll take your question. We took some of those ERA dollars to provide a loan loss reserve. So the way it works is we provide a limited undertaking for losses that those banks might experience in return for them bringing down their interest rates that they otherwise would charge for unsecured loans. So that's the magic of how that works.
So how do you coordinate, I guess this is the best word I can come up with, when you have many different companies in Connecticut outselling solar IPPs to individual house. First of all, are they vetted for obvious reasons? And secondly, one of the problems with IPPs are the energy that they displace, but then the cost of energy doesn't go down because it's intermittent. And policy-wise, how do you mesh that into your energy grid in a way that has overall benefit?
Sure. I think I do, or at least I try. As far as the contractors are vetted. They have to apply. They have to provide the fact that they are registered. They're licensed as home improvement contractors. They have to have adequate insurance to be admitted into the program, and they also have to be trained by us in terms of understanding how our program works. Furthermore, there is a QA/QC quality assurance and quality control program that we have in place to make sure that the projects, once they're completed at the homeowner's residence, they're checked off, make sure that they were installed properly and they're functioning properly. So that's our vetting process. We also have a list that we established together with the utilities, because the utilities offer incentives on a number of these measures. So we work together to provide a range of activities that qualify for the loan program. So the bank does not get involved with the qualification side. They just do the underwriting of the customer. So we keep everybody in the camp that they're comfortable being in. So banks just qualify the customer, and what we do is we qualify the measure or the range of measures that are being done. So those two sides come together and automatically through an internet portal, and it basically says approved here, approved there, you can go ahead and do your transaction. As far as what we're talking about with the IPP, were you referring to
just the effect on the grid? I mean, you also have the federal credit program for IPPs that have gone over the last 8 years or so, and so they were also part of this whole equation. But then that had ways of filtering down to the homeowners, but it also has in some respects a disruption in the grid until you change how that grid operates, and you still have a basic capital cost of the grid.
Yeah. Connecticut does not have the penetration of solar PV where that's even remotely becoming an issue. California is experiencing that in certain certain neighborhoods, certain parts of their grid. Hawaii, even, which has had a tremendous explosion in solar PV. So trying to, you're right, integrating these intermittent resources into the grid that was built really for one-way delivery of power from a central power source out, you know, it's not really. But a few comments on that. One is we're not in the area of penetration where that really is an issue. Second of all, there are upgrades that sometimes are necessary. And what happens is those improvements are paid for by a combination of the contractors and the homeowners where they happen. That's not a particularly fair way, in my opinion, that, you know, nine people come along and have solar PV done in the area, and then you're the tenth and lucky one, and they say, you're it. Yeah. You have to pay for the improvement, which can be, you know, a few $1,000s in terms of a grid improvement that, you know, then benefits the next nine or ten other people, but you were the one that, you know, lost in the lottery. So there are these pains that happen, but they really have are really pale in comparison to the benefits that solar PV have brought in terms of distributed generation. The other thing is our policy has net metering, so that net metering is where if your system, your solar system, is generating excess more energy than you're using for your home, then you generate a credit, you know, back with your utility, which you can then draw on at night or periods of the year when your solar production is lower. So that's how we integrate it.
And it's still, but you still have the overall, and I'm just sorry. Still have the overall rub with the basic cost of the grid that's been there before you had the net metering. I just was wondering, as a policy level, since you're a state agency, how you've dealt with that.
Mm-hmm. We work with our regulatory authority and with the utilities hand in glove. It's an ongoing evolution, I think, that's happening throughout the country. All I can say is that, you know, we have an ongoing dialogue, and there's really I'm gonna say our utilities are really working positively to try. They see these distributed resources as beneficial, taking stress off the grid. Mm-hmm. Their point is, let's do it. Can we do it in a little bit more planned fashion? So instead of maybe providing a uniform incentive to everybody everywhere, maybe we provide an enhanced incentive where we've got, you know, an area that needs more generation, could use more support there. But that's a good dialogue to have, so because we'll end up with a stronger grid as a result.
Thank you.
And someone in my prior presentation asked about interest rates. Our interest rates range from 4.49% to 6.99%. That's from 5 years to 12 years. So it's a moderate amount of interest. It's clearly affordable. But we also use our ERA money to buy down those interest rates to make it even more affordable. And we do that when the homeowner decides to do more. So if you decide to do more as a homeowner, we'll bring down the interest rate even lower for your project.
So the Green Bank, to make these unsecured loans lower interest, you just have to provide a guarantee sort of to the banks.
Yes.
That if someone defaults, you will cover that loss for them, and so it makes them basically securing their unsecured loan.
Well, yes, it's enhancing. We call it enhancing, credit enhancing the loan.
Well, if someone doesn't pay, do you guys cover the loss?
Well, the way it works, and to give a very simple example, we give a percentage of the loan a loss reserve benefit. So in our case, it's generally 7.5% of the loan goes into an account at the Green Bank for the benefit of the lender. So if the lender makes $1 million worth of loans, we'll put $75,000 in the account to withstand losses, credit losses. But what we say to the credit union and the community bank is, you're in the business of making loans, you're going to have some losses. We just want to demonstrate to you that you won't have excess losses on your portfolio. So the first 1.5%, or in that example, $15,000, is retained loss by the lender. So if they have a loss that's now bigger in aggregate, beyond $15,000, they can go after the $75,000 reserve 100%.
And that's their money that they put in?
No, it's our money.
Right, so it's your money
from ERA funds.
Okay.
Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds, okay, that we got from the Department of Energy, State Energy Programs.
Got it.
Okay. But here's the point, Mr. Chairman, is that in 3 years, we've done $16 million worth of loans. Two of those loans have actually defaulted and, you know, didn't pay, but that was below the retained loss threshold. So even though the Green Bank's is standing behind with a certain amount of money, so it's not an unlimited deep pocket,
right?
It's just a limited amount of money, not one penny of that reserve has been used.
Right.
So we think it's really good to leverage funds that way. So another portion I wanted to move the presentation along. We also service our low-income residents, but and that's a misconception. Many people think that low-income people have a poor credit history. It's low-income, you can have poor credit if you're making, you know, way above median income, and you can have great credit if you're of less average means. And so what we've demonstrated is that through reaching out through our partners, community development financial institutions, which specialize in lending to these populations, that they're good risks, but they just need a different approach. And we're working with partners like Posigen in the middle of this slide. The focus is on the lower income communities, as well as working through community partnerships to bring solar and energy efficiency, importantly, to these residents. This gets back to the whole issue that I mentioned about the energy burden. Yeah, many of these families are overlooked, and that's because the national solar or companies just bypass these communities. They go after the middle income and higher populations. But we say that we have a saying of solar for all, as well as energy efficiency for all. Solar, generally, in our neck of the woods, is only good for about 10% of the homes, or maybe 15%. And that's because there has to be a particular orientation. In Connecticut, we have lots of trees, so, you know, not everybody can use solar, but everybody can use energy efficiency. So that's why, even though a particular home might not be able to use solar, they get the benefit of the energy efficiency through these programs. This is just a picture showing Governor Malloy. He's third from the right there. The president of Posigen is on the right, Tom Nahart, and this is with the first family to get solar in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And the woman there in the white jacket, she was so delighted with her system, she couldn't stop talking about it. She became one of their salespeople and is now on staff with Posigen. She became a real diplomat and salesperson for them in town. So, and you can see in the lower part of that picture, just, you know, house after house just has solar, and that's an actual neighborhood there in Bridgeport. So it's just amazing to see. again, this is just reinforcing this whole idea of, you know, homes being heated with oil. Mm-hmm. So we do use a lot of oil, but the oil being used is for heating homes. So I think, yeah, so about...
Well, a couple of pages before, you had convert to natural gas as one of...
Right. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And we are too. So what we'll do is we'll try to convert that home to natural gas, which is much cleaner in terms of emissions, and also and has been up until more recent times a price benefit. That price benefit has come down as the price of home heating oil has dropped. Gas still has a bit of an advantage. That equation might be a little different up here in Alaska. But we work to try to provide these energy savings agreements for these low-income homeowners to try to bring that energy burden down. We are also a very important repository of information for energy efficiency as well as solar in the state. This happens to be a solar spotlight, but we also have energy efficiency resources, so it's really one-stop shopping for information. And we're really working in partnership with the utility. It's the brand name is called Energize CT. So all of the utilities are under that umbrella, and so is the Green Bank. So we're working in partnership.
This is maybe a question for Chris, but how would the AEA, Alaska Energy Authority, sort of be compared to something like this as far as acquiring funds or knowledge of projects and, you know, he was just saying about one-stop shop.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, in this state, we've got two agencies. I'm sorry, Chris Rose. In this state, we have two state corporations, Alaska Energy Authority and Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, that both do energy efficiency. They both have knowledge. They both have programs. HFC has more on the energy efficiency side. AEA has had more on the generation side. I think that HFC, being a finance institution, is more similar but not the same as a Green Bank. And I would say that ADA, Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, is much more like a Green Bank, except it doesn't have that focus. And that it can, as does HFC, take advantage of federal programs, federal money, and then reintegrate those funds into new programs. So to answer your question, I would say AEA is not like that because they're not a finance institution per se.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks. Thank you, Chris. The next area I wanted to talk about briefly is our support for multifamily property owners. This is a very challenging area because it's an area where people are, for the most part, they're renting their units. Sometimes they're co-ops and condominiums. But we work with a lot of landlords who own the building, but the actual resident may be paying the electric bill. So it's kind of a split incentive there where the person paying the bill is not really able to encourage the landlord. But we work with these landlords to really get them to understand the value of the energy efficiency benefits that can be realized on the property.
Go ahead. Related to that, mm-hmm. The PACE bill that we passed, mm-hmm. which is probably the same as the PACE bill you guys work with, the improvement stays with the property. So if someone was to sell the property, they would assume the loan.
Yeah.
And so it's an incentive for someone who may not know how long they're going to own a property if they want to invest in a 20-year payback kind of thing.
That's right.
How do you account for any of that, or can you incorporate any of that?
Yes, we do. In fact, I'm coming up to it. The next slide. You're ahead of me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
So we work with pre-development resources, pre-development loans that actually offer the ability to explore transaction, to actually size up the property, determine what kind of improvements are needed for the property to make it more energy efficient. Quite often, that's the big first step is getting those resources that that they can use to fund that exploratory process. Sometimes that takes $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, but for a lot of these landlords, that's $25,000 they don't have, and so they just won't move. But we'll provide that as a loan. And then we'll allow that loan to be wrapped up into the next phase, which is on this next slide, which is provided through a number of different categories, including one that's called our Lime Loan, our low-income multifamily energy loan. CPACE is up there, you'll see. And we even provide additional, what's called gap financing, where you have a project that might have asbestos, or it might have old wiring. Like I said, our old building stock is, goes back to the 30s and 40s, and wiring that's just a nightmare. Those things that just need to be addressed to address health and safety issues of the home. Lead pipes, replacing those. So we'll actually add a little bit of extra financing money in there as a green bank and wrap that into the loan. Did that address your question on PACE or it's just one of the options that we have. So we've had a lot of success to date, multifamily. In solar, we've done 1,300 residential units across those several towns in the upper part of the slide there. And we've also done another 1,300 units in terms of energy efficiency and solar projects in the lower part of the slide. So this is all in a year and a half. I mean, it's just an incredible amount of progress that we've achieved in a short period of time. And how do we get that progress is because we work with our partners out there in the field. We have the Department of Housing. We have a Healthy Homes Initiative from our Department of Public Health. All of these and our utilities that I mentioned before, we work with technical assistance specialists like New Ecology. All these partners make it possible for us to actually find and get to the actual units that need our help. And then we use different resources like the MacArthur Foundation that has provided some funding for us. We use our own balance sheet. We use CPACE, so Hannon Armstrong and their facility. We work with our community development financial institutions, Capital for Change, as mentioned there. All of these are partners. So we just use all of these. We're really a hub around all of these different resources that we know how to bring the two sides together, the capital side as well as the project side. Then CPACE, another area that's very big for us. Again, more than $100 million of transactions in just over 2 years. And so we provide support for business owners and not-for-profits, municipalities, and schools through CPACE, as well as our solar lease program that I mentioned very early on, the fund that I mentioned. I won't go into what PACE is because I think this committee is very familiar with PACE and that it allows 100% financing. In our case, we go up to 25 years, but that's because we're very have a lot of transactions that are done for solar PV. So we started off with 20 years, but our building owners kept saying, can you go to 25? because really this technology lasts, beyond 25 years. We asked Hannon Armstrong if they would be willing to do 25 years, and they said that they would. So if private capital is willing to do it, we said, why should we stand in the way? So that's how we ended up going to 25 years. But we have many of the same provisions in our bill as you have. A savings to investment ratio test, meaning that the savings over the period of time has to exceed the assessment on the property. So That's the last item on the bottom right there. So, and as I mentioned, this is that $50,000 boiler for a church. This is the situation on the left that was really on its last legs, and so now it's that was an oil-fired boiler on the left, and moved to a natural gas-fired, totally digital system. The minister said, it's so great, I can turn it on from home, and when I step into the pulpit, it's nice and warm in the church. So,
hallelujah.
Yeah. And so you go from that $50,000 boiler to again a $2.5 million entire building retrofit in the upper left hand corner there, a commercial office building in Bridgeport. But we also work with not for profits like the Bushnell Center in Hartford, state seat of government. They needed some financing to change out their HVAC, which was on its last legs. So they really saw this as a way. They said, yeah, we can't raise that money in a capital campaign, but if we could get a CPACE loan and finance the improvement over 20 years, that'd make it just a little bit of money that we have to have each year. And so it was just an amazing transformation for them. So they loved the program. Solar lease, I mentioned that KeyBank and U.S. Bank came together with our first fund to do all of these, provide solar for all these different types of users, including our public schools, school districts. Very big believers in solar PV, and each school district operates independently, and so any improvement in school budget they're able to put into program in education. Mm-hmm. So they also look at it as part of education for their students in terms of clean energy. So lots of benefits there. I put the other indication of a transaction on the right there that we just closed with Onyx. Onyx is a subsidiary of Blackstone, one of the largest private equity companies in the world. That just shows you that they've come to Connecticut. We're a small state, 3.5 million people, but they saw the how our program was really reaching all of these different organizations. They specialize in commercial solar. They wanted to be a part of it, and they bid into our RFP and won on the basis of what they were willing to provide. So we've gone now. We actually, in the first transaction, we were putting our money into the solar fund. In this next fund, we're putting no money in.
Is that right?
We're just originating. So we're just providing the platform at this point, because we have all the connections with the contractors, and so we're really just an intermediary, and we get paid for originating the transactions by Onyx.
How much of this activity do you think is ascribed to the fact that solar has come down in price? I mean, of your portfolio, how much of it is solar? It seems like a lot.
About half,
okay. Mm-hmm. Because in Alaska, I think solar's starting penetrate a little more.
Because cost
is coming down, efficiency is going up, and although we're a cold, dark state, there are some applications for solar, but probably not as easy to pencil out as mm-hmm. Connecticut, I would imagine, just geographically. But I just didn't know how much of this is solar inspired, and you're saying about half.
Well, in this particular facility, it's 100%.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I'm
solar. Yeah.
I just
right.
mean
yeah. overall
yeah.
about half.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tim Johnson.
Yeah.
How much of your portfolio is heat exchange? Thermal.
Oh, thermal. Would that include like boilers and things?
No, I was thinking more. Sorry, I'm having the senior. Yeah, heat pumps.
Mm-hmm. Oh, heat pumps is a small portion right now, but it's an increasing portion. We actually have a big thermal effort on right now, so it's small now.
I would just say several million, you know, probably in the single digits at this point. But it's growing because we've just turned an emphasis to heat pumps as part of that part of our strategy.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. This is a Small Business Energy Advantage Program. This is how we work with our local utility. They actually approached us because they were running out of funds for their small business program, making these 3 to 4 year long loans to their commercial customers, small business customers. These are usually quick payback LED lighting conversions, low-hanging fruit. They'll pay back in 3 or 4 or 5 years. So they're running out of money, and they asked us if we could help them find more capital for it. So they also said, you know, we have these loans on our books, and we don't want to be the lender anymore. And the key question we asked them is, will you still be the on-bill provider of the repayment? And they said that they would. We told them that that was essential for making it work because we figured we could find capital that was willing to back the facility, but it would have to rely on bill repayment. So we've actually RFP'd for a capital source. We generated $300 million worth of proposals for a $75 million program. And J.P. Morgan Chase is in the final stages now of committing under a term sheet with us for that program. So that's just an example where now the utility will have literally a never-ending stream of capital because that money will come from the private capital market. They don't have to go to their corporate treasurer and say, "Will you give me another $5 million, another $10 million for this program this year?" You know, all we have to do is go to the private lenders and say, you know, just up your facility. And this this portfolio or this program has been in existence for 10 years. Its loss rate is 1%. So the utility is going to put up a loss reserve itself to actually backstop the loans, and that's the protection that is sufficient enough. So in this case, the Green Bank's participation is very minimal. We're providing the vehicle there to actually secure the revenue stream for the lenders. And we're providing a little bit of transactional liquidity. So in case the program needs an advance and we're in between advance points on the private capital, the Green Bank will provide or could provide a little bit of money to keep things rolling along. So we're really facilitating the transaction, not really taking any risk here. But it's just an example of how the Green Bank can be instrumental in a program, and the capital cost from the marketplace is going to be somewhere in the vicinity of 4 to 5%, whereas from the utility it was costing 9.5% and 10%. Mm. So a lot less cost, a better overall program for the ratepayers. State facilities. I think that here in Alaska there's a fair amount of interest and activity in state buildings in Connecticut too. I wish we were moving faster. But we're showing some progress. So we're doing some transactions with general obligation bonds as well as green bonds from the Green Bank, and we're now exploring a possible energy service agreement arrangement with the Green Bank, which would take the transaction off of the state's balance sheet because it would convert a capital investment into more of a service contract with the Green Bank. So the Green Bank would have all of the obligations backed by a revenue stream under a service agreement, you know, with the state agency, and then the capital provider would look toward that contract as well as a guarantee from like a Johnson Controls or Siemens, you know, that provides a performance contract guarantee to the Green Bank to make sure that this energy savings are being experienced by the agency.
Representative Johnson.
So how do you integrate the GL bonds in that I'm a little confused in that scenario.
Well, the Green Bank would actually issue bonds to the capital provider.
Okay.
So, you know, if the so in return for issuing bonds to a capital source, either a bank or insurance company, those funds would come into the Green Bank under a bonding mechanism, okay, but not the state's bond.
I was going to say, so you can't use the municipal or state bond, you can't integrate that into this?
Well, if you did geo bonds and it would be on the state's balance sheet, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
So the state could do its own financing, but as an alternative, if you're looking at doing hundreds of millions of dollars of these and really opening up, you know, a potential activity that Chris was talking about earlier, then energy savings agreements could be a way of doing that that would reduce the burden of the bonds being on the state's balance sheet. So we're looking at that because we're constrained in terms of a bond limit that we can't issue in a particular year. So instead of competing for school buildings and roads and bridge repair and things like that, we're saying, well, let's maybe take that off the table and not have to go through the bonding process, but we'll use energy savings agreements to solve the problem. So we're looking at that as an option.
I think I get it.
Mm-hmm. I can talk to you after the committee meeting in more detail. We also do grid size projects. This is a fuel cell project in Bridgeport. The actual capital cost was about $65 million. We provided $5 million of financing to actually incentivize the buyer to complete the transaction. It's the largest fuel cell project in North America at 15 megawatts. We develop a lot of, finance a lot of microgrids that go into cities and towns.
Fuel cell. This is just,
yes, sir.
This is just straight up just a PowerPoint, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It has a power purchase agreement with a local utility.
So a local utility built this project.
The fuel cell manufacturer built the project. And the project was bought by Dominion Resources out of Virginia. They're a Virginia power utility that has investments all over the United States. They actually own the nuclear power plant in Connecticut, Millstone, and they wanted to diversify into other power generation resources, so they decided to buy this fuel cell. Mm-hmm. Microgrids for resiliency and backup power to make sure that if the grid loses power, that critical parts of the town are still lit, like town hall or a hospital or a bank, Starbucks. those stay online so that people can get their lattes. seriously, it's very important for a number of these facilities to be built. We actually completed in Bridgeport a police station and senior center combination so that in time of a blackout, the seniors can, as well as other members of the community, if they need to get to an area that's lit and has heat, etc., they can go there. And of course, it's very important to have first responders maintain their power. Anaerobic digesters. We have a big organics problem in our state. This is what I like about Connecticut, is it gets the policy right. So one of the policies that we have is that if an anaerobic digester is built in a portion of the state, within a 20-mile radius of that plant, large organic producers have to supply their organics to that anaerobic digester.
So it works in concert with the Green Bank that can then finance, go to banks and get co-financing to put the anaerobic digester in place. And now, because these organic producers have to deliver their organics, you know, to the facility, then that digester can then earn what are called tipping fees, tipping the organics at the digester location, and then they also make revenue from the sale of electricity because the methane gas is then run through a reciprocating engine and a generator. Wind, we actually have some utility scale wind, 5 megawatts in part of the state. We provided some subordinated debt that encouraged 7 times leverage from a tax equity investor, as well as a regular bank loan. We have a small hydro in our state, many rivers and water impoundment facilities, dams. So this is an example where we took technology that was commercially applied over in Europe, and we brought it to the United States. This is one of the transactions that was worked on by our Clean Energy Fund. It was actually, we provided financing to the developer to explore this activity and get it to a commercial phase in the United States. And the Green Bank actually took over, you know, years later, and provided a green bond that was purchased by Bank of America to actually finance the screw. And that's actually working today. It just started up within the last month. So really good progress there. It's not much in terms of power output, just under 200 kilowatts. But the fact is that you can put these anywhere.
Yeah.
And so throughout New England, they're now looking at a series of dams to put these projects in. And the benefit of the Green Bank is, without the Green Bank being there to take that first risk, we looked at it and said, it's working in England, it's working in the Netherlands, you know, it's working all over. Yeah. Why don't we just bring it here pretty much as a pilot prototype project? Because bankers like to see it, and they're not going to fly to England to go see this screw turning. But if we say, come to Meriden, Connecticut, you can see a real live, you know, screw turning and see the power being generated. Then they'll say, oh, okay, yeah, we get it, it works. And then they'll expand throughout New England and throughout the United States and actually, you know, put these finance these projects.
Well, that brings to mind the presentation we had from one of the utilities. It had a dam that was built with federal dollars in the 40s or 50s or something like that, and they wanted to use different funding to try to get it workable again.
Yeah, repowering the
water.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember if it was working or not.
It's a water dam.
Yeah. It was for a reservoir.
For water.
It wasn't for energy production.
No, they wanted to. Yeah, they wanted to. Well, so. I mean, I think the issue for Alaska is, for example, the last two, wind and hydro would be great in rural Alaska, and that's what we really need.
Yeah.
The number of consumers is very small, but the cost of the project is pretty high, and again, we had several utilities in here a couple weeks ago, and they had projects that they showed, you know, hydro projects or different. Alternative energy projects they had, and mostly with grant money. And I said, if you had to buy the money, would these projects be feasible? And they pretty much all said no. Mm-hmm. So, and I guess that's really the crux of what you do, mm-hmm. and to try to make it feasible so that mm-hmm. a lot of these communities could mm-hmm. get one of these aforementioned projects, a water screw or something like that.
Right.
I'd love to see that happen. So,
well, actually, this one was financed by Clean Renewable Energy Bonds. It's a program that's still, who knows with Washington how long it'll be going, but there's still an allocation of Clean Renewable Energy Bonds. I think there's maybe $250 million that's left. But what we did was we used that program to bring down the cost of financing to roughly about 1.5%, so over 20 years. And then we used another state program that actually brought the cost of money down to less than 1%. So, but we were able to use a federal program to get it down to 1.5%. That's pretty much free money.
And
go ahead.
Yeah, through the chair, how much did this project cost?
This was a $4 million project because it was the first one.
Okay.
It was the first one. It's very, and we make no bones about it. It's expensive. However, in a state where electricity is costing the city 15 cents per kilowatt hour, this is being done for the city, I believe, at about 12 cents a kilowatt hour. Mm-hmm. So it's still a discount for the city. And they've signed up for a 20-year power purchase agreement, which is extendable. So that gives us the long contract life to recover our investment.
Well, follow-up. I mean, in Alaska, a $4 million project that would produce enough energy for 115 homes, that's cheap. For some of our rural communities, that's you know, remarkably cheap and inexpensive, and the kind of thing that we could do, even if you, you know, inflated the cost to, you know, address for the increased construction cost. I mean, it's much cheaper to do construction in Meriden, Connecticut, I imagine, than it would be in some of our southeast villages, where everything has to get in and out on a boat. But right. I mean, even if you doubled the price to $8 million, but the math still works in a lot of Alaska.
Well, I'd certainly love to explore it with you. And again, keep in mind that $4 million price tag included a lot of expense and development costs that probably about $1 million worth that wouldn't be present if we were doing this again. In other words, the second screw would cost $3 million.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And also, the economy is a scale. If we were to do another screw side by side with that, that you can clearly do, mm-hmm. you know, it's made to be replicable side by side, then the cost goes down considerably because you're literally just making another concrete channel, and it's.
Right.
I'll get you some videos of how it came together. It's just remarkable to see how quickly, you know, this can be constructed. They started in November.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. They started in September and finished in December. So, and then largely from December to now was all the tightening up and making sure the switch gear and everything else was in place. And then when you have to take away they don't call it ballast. What is the word I'm working for? The protection that holds back the water from the pond. So they have to take that apart. So it's a bit of a process to get everything flowing again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what takes the time. But construction is pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty quick. Foundations and use of green bonds. Some of this I already talked about. I won't repeat it. But we do work with foundations. There's foundation money out there, particularly when you're looking at servicing, providing services to disadvantaged communities. So I would say that the Green Bank community is very able to access resources like this, particularly if you have a vision and you say, well, this is what we're trying to do here and here, we're doing it the old way, but we need a little bit of assistance. Quite often, these foundations have been willing partners to step forward to help us in bringing energy efficiency and clean energy services to these populations. Green bonds, I mentioned the CREBS, the Clean Renewable Energy Bonds for the screw. CPACE, those were our first green bonds, really. When we sold $20 million to Clean Fund back in 2014, those are certifiable green bonds. We packaged the transaction. If you know the process of securitization, where you put a pool of loans under a secure facility, and then you issue bonds under an indenture. But the only revenue stream that's getting paid to the bondholder is through those loans under the facility. That's what we did with CPACE, and those were our first green bonds. Hannon Armstrong is going to take those investments that they're putting in our CPACE program, and they're going to issue green bonds off of them, together with other transactions that they have. The Small Business Energy Advantage program that we have with the Alette Power Utility, we have visions of maybe issuing commercial paper because it's a short-term facility, and that would bring down the cost of capital even more. We also are looking at doing renewable thermal, as you mentioned, Representative, and also expanding into storage technologies and EV networks. This is a good role for the Green Bank because EV charging networks are very good in urban areas. I'm trying to remember if I saw that that Juno was actually looking into EV charging. So this is an area where a Green Bank, with its long-term balance sheet, can actually provide financing over a longer period of time, where a commercial bank can only go for 5 or 7 years, but maybe wants to participate in some way. So the Green Bank can do, stand in there for 20 years, and the commercial bank can fund maybe the shorter term aspects of the facility.
Representative Wilson.
Yes, and through the chair, thank you. So, Mr. Hunter, what I'm interested in is the EV is something like that when we start to use, and we are excited here in Alaska, especially rural Alaska, with the Tesla battery that's coming in. So that'd be something you're interested in. Is that something you're working on now?
Yes, absolutely. I would say that the technology is rapidly changing. The battery capacities are getting better. They have longer ranges now. Yeah. So whereas I have a Chevy Volt, it'll only go 50 miles. But fortunately, it's a hybrid, so I can keep going. Even 100 miles isn't really ideal for my conditions because I do a lot of driving around the state looking at these various projects and programs. But if I had a 250-mile or 300-mile range, that'd be ideal. So that's where the technology is going, and I think that as that longer range gets established, then you need the fast chargers that cost more money to install to actually service those cars with the bigger range.
Well, I can tell you this is a little bit older technology, maybe two gens ago, but what it is you can get 30 miles in constantly unless it's 30 below or something,
right.
then you can barely run it, then you immediately plug it in, the coal just wipes it out.
Right. That's right.
How would these stations work, say in Juneau, the plug-in
right.
facilities, how would you foresee something like that happening?
You'll have various ways of doing it. Sometimes it's workplace charging, sometimes it's charging at shopping areas. Mm-hmm. You put it where the activity is going to be and where people are going to rest for a while.
I mean, the financing and the power production, how does that, how do you guys figure into that equation?
Well,
as opposed to just
every time
someone building meters that someone
sure
a card or something.
Yeah. Well, they're networks. ChargePoint is one such network, but there are other networks that where everybody would have that wants to use it would have either on their iPhone or have a card to be able to swipe in to be able to use the charger, and then literally it goes to your credit card. You build off your credit card. Mm-hmm. For the use of the charging station. Mm-hmm. You could provide the energy for free if you like, but I don't think.
No, but I mean, how does the Green Bank figure into that sort of?
We provide the capital to build out the network.
Okay.
Just pure and simple.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
For whoever's selling the electricity.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's part of the challenge. Part of the challenge is the charger itself is really cheap. That's maybe the unit itself is maybe $3,000.
Right.
You know, for just a regular charger, a high speed charger, fast chargers is more expensive. The real cost is in the installation. You know, putting the concrete in the ground, the interconnection to the power, to the grid. You know, that's where the expense comes in. Some of this can even be rate based. You know, California is looking at that approach. Pacific Gas and Electric is doing that. So they're rate basing some of the infrastructure. You can use that approach. You can use a co-approach. We had one of our utilities approach us, and they said, we'll actually fund everything from the power source, you know, out to the stub. We'll do that part. If you do the rest, if Green Bank, you take over the rest. So that's an example where we can co-finance, you know, with the utility, and the utility would basically rate base that portion of the work that they're doing, and that would be part of their network. So there are many approaches.
Mm-hmm. Representative Johnson?
Two questions. What are you doing, or are you participating as far as storage on the grid, not just the personal storage?
Mm-hmm.
Are you financing some of that with the utilities? Are you looking forward as far as what that means?
We are looking into it. We're not where California is, where they're doing, you know, really megawatts worth of storage. We're really more at the neighborhood level of storage, and so we actually have a pilot program with one of our utilities to actually. It really gets to your question earlier. That you were talking about, and the utility actually approached us, and they said, what we want to do is we want to take a neighborhood, and we want to maximally invest in solar PV and put storage in place so that we can see how these intermittent resources work. So that's actually a pilot we have underway right now. So we're actually taking a neighborhood, putting PV, you know, like 80-90% of the neighborhood's going to be PV, and then we're going to have solar plus storage so that we can actually see how it responds, you know, throughout the day and throughout the entire year. But in terms of doing storage, we'll provide our Smart E-Loan for a homeowner to buy storage. That's a power wall that's up there. It's a Tesla power wall. But actually it was SolarCity I think they were marketing it, but that's their power wall. It's a storage device that works with their solar PV. Yeah, so we'll finance that.
All this as far as the electrical power stations, are you
watching? I think it's Honda who is now just skipping completely the electrical car and going to hydrogen fuel. And I think they're doing that now, I think, in the Bay Area and Vancouver.
Yeah, California.
Yeah. And are you watching that?
We're watching it. The cars are expensive. So the cars themselves are expensive. They're and the build-out of the infrastructure is expensive. So roughly $1 million to $1.25 million per build-out of a natural gas, you know, filling station. So personally, I think it's very challenged by the sheer economics of it. If you look at the fact that an EV is typically you can get EVs in the $27,000 to $40,000 range, excluding Tesla, which is its own category of car. But if you look at natural gas vehicles, they're in the $60,000 to $70,000 range. So it's a much more expensive proposition. So you have to deal with rebates to bring down the cost, and we just don't see it as being sustainable yet. You know, maybe that'll change over time. But.
And I think these are hydrogen fuel cells.
Yeah.
Follow up. Just. I actually was at an Angel Fund conference in Vancouver, and I saw one of the designs was making the storage into a container like this, So I'm just, right. It's just something to watch.
Yes. Yes, I would agree.
I mean, that's a whole other conversation. I wouldn't mind asking more questions about, but we only have a few minutes left, and I want to get you to the end of your presentation. I also have a couple questions relating more to our situation in Alaska, as much as I like talking about hydrogen.
I think I just have one slide, and then I'll go to the general question. I just wanted to say that, that green banks are part of an entire global movement. We're part of the Green Bank Network, which extends all the way from the U.S., includes the New York Green Bank, Connecticut, the U.K. Green Bank, the Australian Clean Energy Finance Corporation. Malaysia has a green finance organization, so does Japan. So it's really a worldwide network. A number of states have initiatives to have green banks. As I mentioned, New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island has an infrastructure bank. New Jersey has a resiliency bank. California has their infrastructure bank that they're looking to dedicate to more green purposes. Mm-hmm. So it's really, Alaska is at a good point in time at looking at this because there are a lot of other institutions that are out there that have already, plowed the ground, made some mistakes. You know, we now have we didn't have a playbook when we started. We have a playbook now. So, you can kind of say, well, what aspects could we use to kind of get things rolling more quickly than, say, even Connecticut? So so I just wanted to offer you that you'd have a lot of friends in the network of green banks who would be willing to help you out.
Mm-hmm. How many states currently have?
Roughly six or seven, I think. Is that right? Yeah, between California, Connecticut, New York.
New York.
Maryland has a county green bank.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned Rhode Island. Vermont has the Vermont Energy Investment Corporation, mm-hmm. VEIC. It's kind of a green bank-like organization. Not exactly a green bank.
Representative Johnson, your question.
I did. I'd done a little research on it, on the Connecticut Green Bank, and it looked like there was some possibility that the legislature was going to pull funding back from it, and I was just wondering what the status of that is at this point and where that may end up at.
Well, yeah, because we're part of government, we're all in with a state budget that's in a financial crisis. As it will be for the next few years, we're always concerned that they'll look at the Green Bank as a piggy bank, but hopefully they'll see that the economic development benefits, it's money well spent where they have it invested. So all we can do is meet with the legislators and tell them all the good things that we've done, all the jobs that we've produced, and to say that we think we're the most efficient use of your resources that you have. And remember that when you take a dollar from the Green Bank, you're actually taking $5 to $10 out of the system, because it works in reverse. It works positively, but works in reverse as well. So if you pull money from us, mm-hmm. you're actually turning the whole process around. So it means you'll have lower investment, not greater investment. So that's really the only thing we can do to address that. But it is risk, is a concern.
Representative Johnson?
Do you ever look at maybe providing a dividend?
Back to the state?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. As our portfolio grows, that will certainly be possible. So we're in an initial growth phase right now, but certainly over time we could definitely provide a dividend back to the state.
I have a question. So your fund starts with you have a excuse me, I forget what you call it when you assess a utility bill. You're doing
a system benefit charge.
System benefit charge, yeah. So a tenth of a cent per kilowatt hour, which amounts to about $10 per house per year. So if Alaska did something like that, maybe Chris knows the answer to this, how much money, you got $27 million or something like that. I don't know how much money that would generate in Alaska, as far as usable capital. The other thing that, you know, this was suggested in one of the AEA did a study, and they had this as one of their recommendations, system benefit charge. And what utilities that, excuse me, utilities expressed some concern about it, and they said, why should our ratepayers pay for projects that are going to go probably in rural Alaska and not benefit their ratepayers directly? Mm-hmm. So I guess two questions. How much money would Alaska make if we had a $0.001 dollar charge? And what's sort of the, you know, assuming that's going to be the argument, what's the response to that?
Mr. Chair, I think we sell about 6 billion kilowatt hours a year. So divide that by 1,000, which is a tenth of a cent, maybe $6 million a year. But most of the people live in the rail belt, and so assumedly they would get most of the benefit because these kinds of programs could benefit people all around the state, not just in rural areas. And as in Connecticut's situation, if the state decided to do something like this, we could have multiple sources of stable revenue, not just a system benefit charge, as has been suggested. It's not the only way to potentially capitalize it at the beginning.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So through the chair for Mr. Rose, you mentioned earlier that we have three different institutions that all have some element of expertise required for Green Bank, AEA, ADA, and AHFC. Have you given some thought as to, you know, which of those institutions would be the best vehicle for this, or for a Green Bank in Alaska, or does it really need to be a separate institution in order to deliver the outcomes that we're seeing, say, in Connecticut?
Future, I think that's still a little bit early to tell. Like I said, there's expertise in banking, certainly at ADA and AHFC. Mm-hmm. There's expertise in energy efficiency and renewables at AEA and AHFC. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of lending out of AEA, but most of the lending really takes place in the two institutions. I think the benefit from my perspective so far in understanding how green banks work is really a specific and discrete focus. Now, ADA has a pretty broad focus. We've met with ADA folks before. We're meeting with HFC people tomorrow and hopefully some AA people tomorrow. I think it's still early days in terms of determining whether or not it would be one of those institutions or it would be something brand new. Mm-hmm. I asked Bert yesterday, or maybe it was this morning, how many people would it take to actually do something like this, and I think the committee this morning asked the same question, and really when it comes down to it, six or seven people can really provide a lot of the expertise to move this along, and as long as you had some back office support on accounting and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I understand you guys have a meeting at noon. Some of us have meetings at noon, and it is noon, so we will end this meeting. But thank you very much, Mr. Hunter, for coming up here and testifying, and
thank you
telling us about your interesting project. Mr. Rose, thank you too,
and thank you very much.
At 12:01, meeting's adjourned.